Now, many, many years ago, I heard John Piper tell a moving but true story of life-saving courage. The story comes from Ernest Gordon's book, Miracle on the River Kwai. The true story tells of a group of POWs working on the Burma Railway during World War II. At the end of each day, the tools were collected from the work party. On one occasion, a Japanese guard shouted that a shovel was missing and demanded to know which man had taken it. He began to rant and rave, working himself up into a paranoid fury and ordered whoever was guilty to step forward. No one moved. All die. All die, he shrieked, cocking and aiming his rifle at the prisoners. At that moment, one man stepped forward and the guard clubbed him to death with his rifle while he stood silently to attention. When they returned to the camp, the tools were counted again and no shovel was missing. Here's one man willing to risk and give up his life so that others might live. Chapter 4 of Esther draws us into an equally true story. Here we have Esther beginning to find the faith and courage to risk her life so that others might live. Now, what brings us to this point in the story is, of course, events covered in previous sermons. For the sake of those who haven't been here for the last few weeks, let me just quickly summarize to you how we got here. King Xerxes threw a bender of a party where his queen, Queen Vashti, refused to be treated as eye candy for the king's pals. She was sacked, and a new queen, Esther, took her place. Then in chapter 3, we're introduced to a man named Haman, the second most powerful man in the empire, who took a great dislike to Mordecai, that's Esther's uncle, and became the sworn enemy of the Jews, or as we have been saying throughout, the Church of the Old Testament. In fact, Haman was so peeved at the entire Church of the Old Testament that he had the king sign into law instruction to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, men and women, women and children, in one day. And this brings us to our need of the hour. The Jews of the empire, the Church of the Old Testament, needs someone to risk their life so that they might live. But at first, it seems unlikely that they would find a candidate. It seems that such a person who would risk their life for the lives of others is unlikely to be found. Now, as news of this government-sanctioned mass murder spread, there was this overwhelming despair amongst the Old Testament church. Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city and cried out with a loud and bitter cry. And in every province where the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. The scriptures is not trying to embellish any kind of situation here for us, and it's right for us to focus on what is happening here. It tells us all these details because it wants us to enter into, to feel the absolute sense of catastrophe that is facing the Old Testament church. This is the worst of all possible outcomes for them. They were to be publicly slaughtered, one and all of them. So throughout the empire, the believing community were crying their eyes out in a sobbing mess of public grief. Their grief is also physically expressed, isn't it? The text says that they tore their clothes and wore sackcloth and ashes. We don't see that kind of thing nowadays, so we don't often know how to make sense of that kind of outpouring of public grief. But what this does, the tearing of the clothes, the putting on the sackcloth, the ashes, it represents their undoing, their decomposition from life itself. They are becoming nothing, worthless. Consider similar events of the prophet Jonah when he sent a message to Nineveh of their coming destruction. And what did the people of that great city do in response to that message of coming destruction? The king of Nineveh arose from his throne, removed his robe, covered himself with sackcloth, and sat in ashes. And he issued a proclamation and published throughout Nineveh, "Let man and beast be covered with sackcloth, and let them call out mightily to God." The imagery here is much the same for Mordecai's people. They reduce themselves to nothing, lamenting the legalized slaughter of their people. It is legalized slaughter of their people, and they are lamenting what is happening to them. If there is to be any hope of rescue, if there is any redemption on the horizon, the story drives us to one solution. Someone needs to go and talk to the king. Perhaps get the king to reverse the law. But going to the king without an invitation means risking your life for the sake of Mordecai's people. You don't go to the king without an invitation. To do so is to risk life for the sake of Mordecai's people. So the question is, who would risk so much? Who would risk that much for the sake of other people? Few candidates seem more unlikely than Esther at first. Remember, Esther is now part of the empire. She is part of the political machinery. Her existence, her security, her place in society depends largely on remaining in the king's good books. Moreover, Queen Esther, herself a Jew affiliated with the Church of the Old Testament, seems somewhat oblivious, out of touch with the fact that a date has been set for the mass slaughter of her people. When she discovered Mordecai in absolute despair, her response is somewhat revealing about what she knows is going on. In verse 4, we read, "When Esther's young woman and her eunuchs came and told her that Mordecai was in despair, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them." As far as Esther could tell, Mordecai was poorly clothed and a new set of clothes would fix his troubles. Mordecai's in bits. We'll give him some new clothes. This'll fix what's going wrong. It would seem Queen Esther was so caught up in empire life, she wasn't even aware that the empire had authorized the murder of her people, her church. She is the unlikeliest of heroines, the least capable of assessing the situation clearly, and then act with life-risking courage. At this point in the story, it's also worth noting that Esther and Mordecai weren't speaking to each other face to face. They weren't addressing each other in person, just hanging out. The text makes clear that they were passing messages to each other through servants. And one such servant was Hatak. Evidently, once Esther realized a new suit of clothing wasn't going to fix whatever troubled Mordecai, she presses in. She presses in on the issue. She shows real character and sympathy here. She really wanted to know what has gone so terribly wrong for Mordecai that he would be in such a state. And then full disclosure is given to her. She is brought up to speed with what's been happening right under her nose. And the thing to note here is that no detail was left out. Queen Esther wasn't given a PG version of an R18 event. Everything is told her. Mordecai told him all that had happened to him, and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her. In doing this, Mordecai wants Esther to get it. Do you get it, Esther? Do you feel the weight of the catastrophe? Do you see clearly that Haman had weaponized the entire empire against every single member of the Old Testament church? The situation really was as bleak and every bit as hopeless as Mordecai's tears and public grief led on. It was bleak and it was hopeless. And Esther has to see it for what it is. But more than just getting it and Esther sensing the hopelessness of the situation, Mordecai wants Esther to see that the problem here is not simply the problem is not simply facing some other people. The problem barreling down at Mordecai is not just a problem facing other people, people that Esther could just as easily ignore or overlook. No, the problem is that Haman has targeted her people, her church. Notice what Mordecai suggests to her in verse 8. Mordecai also gave, this is the messenger, a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, and command her to go to the king to beg his favor and plead with him on behalf of who? On behalf of her people. That's the issue. That's the issue that Mordecai is pressing on Esther. Haman wasn't looking to execute people Esther was vaguely familiar with. Haman wanted to destroy her people. And so the question now facing Esther is a question of identity and allegiance, where will it lie? Remember, Esther had grown up in that church of the Old Testament. She had grown up amongst those people. She was even adopted by one of her members. She was, at least in her younger years, a participant in their story with God. The question now is, did the comforts and the prestige she experienced in the empire as queen imprint a new identity upon her? Has she become someone else that is not covenantally linked to God? It's interesting, as a side note here, that this question of identity is teased out for us somewhere else in the book of Esther also. In the whole book, she's the only character that's identified for us by two names. In chapter 2, we learned that Mordecai was bringing up Hadassah. That's a distinctly Jewish name. That is Esther. Whereas Esther is a name that would blend into the empire quite nicely. So she is presented to us with two names, two identities. The question of her true identity now reasserts itself. Will she live up to her Jewish spiritual identity as a member of the covenant people of God, the church? Or has the empire of Xerxes become her new source of identity? To put Mordecai's command in the form of a question, will you, Esther, go to the king and beg his favor and plead on behalf of your people? Who is your people, Esther? Who do you regard your people to be? The question of identity is one that faces Christians, I'm sure. It's not an unfamiliar theme in the Bible either. The great leader of the Old Testament church, Moses, he had to face a similar question in his lifetime, didn't he? Remember, Moses, a Jew and member of the Old Testament church, was raised in Pharaoh's house as a son of Egypt, not Israel. Moses had full access to the privileges, the wealth, the education, the contacts, the luxuries, the comforts of the empire. But eventually, Moses had to decide, who does he identify with? Does he identify with the empire, or does he belong with the covenant people of God? As the book of Hebrews records, by faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. You see how Moses too had to face this very difficult question of, who am I really? Do I belong to the empire of the world, or do I belong to God's kingdom? You need to make that decision also. You need to know whom you belong to. Where is your true identity? Where does your allegiances lie? The same choice was staring Esther in the face. Will she choose to stand with her people, or will she choose the empire? And boy, oh boy, this is not an easy decision to make, is it? For Esther to stand with her people requires a proactive strength derived from true biblical faith. It's the only way she would make that choice to stand with her people is by faith. She would need to discover a strength that she had not seen before. As we've seen up to now in Esther, much of Esther's life has been lived passively. She just had to roll with the punches that life gave her. Her parents died when she was young, so she was adopted by a family member, Mordecai. When the king wanted a sexy new queen, she's commandeered to the harem. Life was happening to her. She was simply rolling with the punches. She is depicted so far in Esther as simply a passenger along for the ride of life. But slowly, and very tellingly in this chapter, her character begins to develop, doesn't it? She slowly steps out from the purely passive Esther to show a remarkable strength. She develops. She grows. She understood why Mordecai wanted her to plead with Xerxes, her husband, for relief. She also knew that this was a very dangerous proposition. Because as verse 11 says, all the king's servants and all the people of the king's provinces know that if a man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court, without being called, there is but one law to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter. Think about Esther's life so far. There's been a lot Esther had no control over in her past. There's no shortage of people telling her what to do in the present, including Mordecai. But finding her feet, her confidence, her courage would only come by true biblical faith. And that faith in the God who makes and keeps promises. Their faith must be rooted in the God who makes and keeps promises. Let's look at verses 13 to 14. And Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place." It will rise from another place. There's a lot to think about here. Firstly, Esther ought to know Haman's killing spree won't spare Jews within the city walls. He signed into law to destroy, to kill, to annihilate all Jews. Whether those Jews stood on the streets or whether they were found in the king's bedroom, it mattered little. The decree is for the destruction of all Jews. But secondly, Mordecai was convinced relief and deliverance would come from somewhere. It would come from somewhere. And this is far more than wishful thinking on the part of Mordecai. This is faith. Mordecai is not hoping against all odds that deliverance will come from somewhere, Esther. He is claiming that. He is making a statement of faith. The deliverance will come. Easter or no Easter, the deliverance will come. And that is an assertion of faith. Relief and deliverance would come from somewhere because it had to. It had to. God's very integrity was on the line. He made a promise, and he has guaranteed to keep it. In ancient times, remember, God placed Abraham under the night sky and said, "Look toward heaven. Look toward heaven and number the stars." If you are able to number them, then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. So think about this situation. If Haman were to succeed in killing every Jew, every descendant of Abraham, God would have broken his promise to Abraham at least. At the same time, he would have broken his promise to humanity that he will rise up in a deliverer from the bloodline of the Jews, a Messiah from the bloodline of the Jews. If all the Jews die as Haman intended, God's promises are null and void. So what does Mordecai do? He recognizes that God made these staggering gospel promises, and then he banks on them. God made this promise and he banks them. That's what faith does. Faith is not an idea or a feeling that just rattles around inside of us. True faith trusts something, it trusts someone. It has a conviction that what is trusted is true, and then entrusts itself to that which it trusts. The old Latin words for these three aspects of faith is notitia, assensus, and fiducia. Mordecai exhibits this kind of well-formed faith, a true biblical faith. He knows the content of what he trusts. He's trusting God. He knows who to trust. He was convinced that the one he trusts makes promises that are trustworthy, that God can be trusted. And then he entrusts his entire future, along with the future of the entire Old Testament church, to the God who made these trustworthy promises. That is faith. That is faith, to look at the promises that God makes and then bank on them, throw yourself at them, trustful into them. As Mordecai said, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews. It had to. And Mordecai was confident in that. So the question is not whether deliverance or relief would come. The only question really is where. What instrument will God use to produce this deliverance and relief? How will he do it? How will he do what he has promised? And Esther too must now contend with this faith. She must consider the possibility of deliverance, for God's people may actually come by her position of power and influence, a position which she neither sought out or aspired to. It's not like she grew up dreaming to be in the king's harem, right? She didn't aspire to this position of influence. She didn't seek it out. But somehow she has obtained it Odd, isn't it? Odd. Perhaps to the credit of the hidden hand of God. Perhaps even for exactly this moment when deliverance was so desperately needed. As Mordecai had now preached the gospel to Esther, that God will surely deliver his people from the judgment of death, Esther must either reject this gospel or believe as Mordecai does. And then she must act, entrusting herself to the God who made the gospel promise to deliver. So we'll have to wait till next time to discover what happened. But for now, we are able to see in this chapter the very true story of a person who was stepping up to the plate. An unlikely heroine who would perhaps consider risking her own life for the lives of her people. And this is very much the gospel prefigured or typified in the Old Testament. Esther is a shadow of the true hero, Jesus, who willingly risked and gave his own life for the lives of his people, for his church. You know, several of these echoes to Christ is already given to us in the text, but I'll just mention two in closing. As Mordecai and the Jews loudly lamented their death sentence, even though they had done nothing to deserve it, so it is with Jesus. As Jesus faced the sentence of death and having done absolutely nothing to deserve it, we are told Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus' cry is the suffering of the innocent, just as the cries of Mordecai's people was the cry of the suffering innocent. The second echo of Christ has already been suggested to you. Jesus was the more excellent Esther. Jesus was the more excellent Esther, who not only risked his life but gave it up so that others may live. This is the crux of our gospel. Jesus, identifying with his people, his church, stood in the way of death's judgment, which threatened to consume us and grip us and hold us. As the scriptures say, we have all sinned, and the wages of sin is death. But Jesus stands in the way. He diverts the ferocious appetite of death's judgment to himself so that his church, his people, can live. Will you believe that gospel? And will you trust the God who makes that promise?